Rogers, I think maybe you can take this. If I wanted to injure this young man up front, I could, there are at least two ways I could do it. I could hit him one finger at a time, or I can make a fist and do it that way. Well, that's Issa Lament, pulling together in order to make a more solid impact rather than individualism. Well, that's something that Kuiper picked up from Groome and Prinster. And so Groome began to sow the seeds of Reformation around the middle of the 19th century. Reformation on every front. School reform. He began a national Christian school movement in the Netherlands. Politically, he began the Christian political movement. In the labor area, in the time when the Industrial Revolution was just getting underway, and the workers in many senses were being oppressed, wage-wise, put in sweatshops and so on, and he said, workers have rights too, God-given ones, that have to be protected. And so he began to organize a Christian labor movement. And he began writing a Christian journalism venture. On every front, he said, Christ is Lord of all and must be honored as such, and his people must begin to stand up and be calmed. Well, that was Groome. In a sense, he was the morning star of a Reformation. In God's providence, it seems that the time was not yet ready for that Reformation. He sowed the seeds, he watered them. But it was Kuiper who finally was able to enter into the harvest. Groome was the pioneer, and toward the end of Groome's life, he began to see Kuiper as his successor. And he began to groom him and shape and mold him for the role of leadership, which he saw Kuiper as picking up after his death. So that when he died in, I think, 1876, Kuiper was already well on the way to becoming the leader of what we call the neo-Calvinist revivals of the 19th century.
Question.
Yes.
I lost you at one point. Which one of those two men, Kuiper or von Prinsteren, was the one who was involved in politics? And you said he was...
Both.
Oh.
So far I've talked only about Groome, who became a member of Parliament.
That's what I mean.
Groome von Prinsteren. Kuiper will also become a member of Parliament later, but we'll get there. Okay. Well, that brings us then really to the third phase in the 19th century reformations within the Dutch Reformed tradition. The first, as you recall, was the Revival movement of the 1820s. And then the Secession movement of the 1830s. And then we get to what is known as the... Some of you know it. The Dolianci movement of the 1880s. And here again, it helps to know some Latin. It's an impossible word to translate. It goes back to the Latin word doleo, which means to mourn or to weep. And the Dolianci was a mourning, weeping movement. Heavy-heartedly, we feel compelled, once again, as our fathers did, to break with the state church. And that happened in 1886. And it happened under the leadership of Abram Kuiper during the time that he was minister in Amsterdam. But that was part of a larger movement. Kuiper recognized just to reform the church isn't enough. If the family, the school, and politics, and labor, and the press, and all the rest remains unreformed, then it does no good to reform the church. Because a reformed church can't counteract 6 days of secularism. Reformations, like deformation, have to take place on the whole front. Not just an isolated pinprick here and there. And so, in that sense, this movement, known as the B movement, in distinction from the A movement, this one was world withdrawing, pietistic, separatistic, this one became very much culturally involved. and announced the lordship of Jesus Christ in a kind of a triumph. This one kind of lived by the cross, if you will, and this one by the resurrection. This one was a suffering type of Christianity, and this one said, we've got to lift the banner of Jesus Christ as Lord and King in the world. And so there's a real spiritual difference anyway. They were both Christian, they were both Reformed in a way, but with a very noticeable difference in emphasis between those two movements. And what I want to talk about next week then, just to look ahead at, where are we now? Because we're heirs of both. And in a sense, the battle of A and B is still being raged in our own hearts, in our own lives, in our own schools, in our own churches, in our own communities. How else do you explain that we have an Outlook magazine and a Reformed Journal magazine?
Now, back at that time, was there any continuity between A and B? In other words, were the same individuals involved in the two as they evolved from one outlook to another, or were they pretty much isolated, separate threats?
At this stage, they were still two fairly independent movements. The Kuiper movement involved more people at the leadership levels of society, more educated people. The AP movement drew only, in a sense, the very poor, the workers, the hired men on the farm, and so on. It drew pretty much from the poor of the country. The second movement, because it was more culturally impacting, it saw a bigger vision, tended to draw people who were more educated, more culturally involved, and so on. Yeah.
Well, were there congregations organized under the A context that perpetuated themselves through the B and maintained themselves independent of the B?
I'll try to draw that line through in just a moment. It has to start in 1892, but I'm going to get there via a couple of other steps. This schism took place, as I was saying, in 1886, after many, many protests and appeals fell upon deaf ears, just as they had in the 1830s. The state church wanted to remain what it was. A controversy had taken place called the Quia and Quatenus controversy. Again, two Latin words. Latin has been the language of the church for centuries, you know, since the Middle Ages. The question was, do we believe the confessions because they are in agreement with the scriptures? Or do we believe the confessions insofar as they are in agreement with the scriptures? And the Orthodox insisted, we believe, we accept the creeds because we believe that they are in harmony with the scriptures. And the liberal says, no, we accept the confessions insofar as they are in agreement. Well, in how far are they? That was left to what was called the lea trae, the freedom of doctrine of every preacher and teacher. And so everyone was free to decide for himself in how far the creeds were authoritative. Now, it was that kind of situation which prevailed in the church. And it was against that that Kuiper and his followers protested, appealed, and finally felt heavy-heartedly, weepingly, in 1886, to break away. So now we have actually two Reformed groups, the one going back to 1834, led by Descartes and Rawls and the others, the A movement, and now the B movement under Kuiper. And those two movements stood side by side for a few years, but finally they recognized that they were brethren of the same house, not only, but that they had come to a rediscovered understanding of what the Reformation was about, even with their differences. And so in the year 1892, a unification was brought about of these two to form what is called the Gereformeerde Kerken of the Netherlands. And all of the Kuiper people joined it. But not all of these joined it, because in this group, there was a good deal of resentment to Kuiper and suspicion of Kuiper. Suspicion, basically, that Kuiper was too worldly. He wants to get involved in politics and labor. He wants Christians to run a press and printing press, come out in newspapers. Kuiper was just too involved in worldly affairs, and they regarded that as too secular because they were more of a withdrawing mentality. I think what happened basically was that the rural areas continued to be largely A, and the urban areas became largely B. Now, that doesn't hold in every case. But these churches of A would not think, I've got to get to that yet, would never dream of calling a minister who had been trained in Kuiper's free university that was established in the 1880s. There were some congregations that always called their ministers from Compton. They wouldn't think of getting anybody from Amsterdam, that worldly city, with a Christian university in a worldly city like Amsterdam. So they went the route of Compton, and other churches always got a B minister from the Free University. And that continued through the 1910s and 20s and 30s and into the 40s. And I don't think it was about the middle of this century before the differences between A and B begin to disappear, with men like Birkhauer at the Free University and Ritterboss at Compton. The A and the B doesn't make any sense anymore there. But it hung on for an awful long time. And most of the early ministers in the Christian Reformed Church came from the A. Because only around the turn of the century did we begin to get immigrants out of the B movement. One such minister was Reverend Fortuyn. I have here a photocopy of a letter in Kuiper's handwriting. In October 5. 1897, and it's written to Lectori Salutum, salutations to whoever reads the letter, to whom it may concern, and it's a letter of recommendation on behalf of Reverend Fortuyn, who's leaving the Netherlands to immigrate to America in 1897, and he doesn't have a call apparently, but he's hoping to get one when he gets here, so Kuiper writes him a letter of recommendation that he can carry along in his pocket, recommending him as a learned man with more than ordinary gifts of pulpitry, who has suffered a good deal on behalf of his loyalty to the scriptures and the faith, and so on. But Fortuyn was one of Kuiper's people. I have here also a photocopy of an article that appeared in Trouw. Trouw was really Kuiper's newspaper that's still being printed in the Netherlands. A newspaper that has a Reformed Christian point of view to it. Well, people doubt whether it still does, but okay. Traditionally, that was true. This is an article by Mr. Fred Lummers about the work of my colleague Herbert Brinks of Heritage Hall and the History Department at Calvin, who spent his sabbatical 2 or 3 years ago going around the Netherlands trying to dig up more stuff. And he dug up some correspondence between Kuiper in Netherlands and Steffens, who taught at Hope College and Weston Seminary in the 1890s, and a certain Reverend Vandermeer. Now, both Steffens and Vandermeer were sympathetic to Kuiper's point of view, the world and life view vision of Kuiper. Kuiper, the story, Herbert Brinks found old correspondence. Immigration plans of Kuiper failed, mislooked. Kuiper was thinking of immigrating in the 1890s. If you've ever read his Stone Lectures, which he delivered at Princeton in 1898, you will sense how enamored he was of the Western world. He thought that the banner of Jesus Christ was moving out of the Middle East across Western Europe into North America. And he wanted to follow that. So he was really tugged by what he saw as the opportunities for a Reformed witness in America. Both Steffens and Vandermeer dissuaded him. He said, don't come to America. You stand a far better chance of
getting a Reformed vision across the Netherlands than you can hear, because America is far too Methodistic, far too fundamentalistic, and so on. So they did a great deal to dissuade Kuyper.
And I don't know that Kuyper ever really came back to the idea. He seems to have dropped it pretty much after that. Although he did come to America the next year, in 1898, at the invitation of Princeton University. Princeton came up out of the Presbyterian tradition in North America, the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, and for a long time had a, I think, distinctively Reformed character about it. It went through the struggles of liberalism in the 19th and 20th century, but it held on for quite a while under the forces of the Alexanders and the Hodges and the Warfields and so on. And it was that Princeton, the old Princeton, which invited Kuyper, who by this time had made quite a name for himself as a leader in Reform circles, to come to deliver six lectures on the auspices of the Stone Foundation. They have been put together into a book called Calvinism, the six lectures. I still use it, even though it's 80 years old. And it's outdated in some very serious ways, and I feel somewhat apologetic about using it, but until somebody does it better, I've got to keep using it because the ideas are right in the book. Okay. And he gave those lectures. At that time, he made a little tour around America. And his English wasn't all too good. He was a guest of Professor Gerhardus Voss, who had taught at Calvin Seminary, left Calvin Seminary to teach at Princeton because he wanted to be where the action was. Okay, because he was of Kuyper's mentality and he thought Grand Rapids is just the backwaters of America. He wanted to be where things were happening. And so he went to Princeton. But Gerhardus Voss started getting worried because Kuyper was touring America and the time was approaching for him to give his lectures. And finally, he located him in California and sent a telegram saying, you better get back, time is near. And Kuyper sent a telegram back in his poor English, I am erring in America. Erring. He meant wandering or I'm getting lost or something, but erring. He was fumbling for the right English word. Meanwhile, 1876, Groen had died. At that point, Kuyper picked up the leadership. In 1880, Kuyper established the Free University of Amsterdam. So in a couple of years, it's going to celebrate its 100th anniversary. He started it in his home on Kaiserstraat in Amsterdam. When I was there as a student in the 1950s, the theology and philosophy were still taught in the Kuyper house on Kaiserstraat, so that's where I bicycled, and that's where I heard Birkhauer and all the other Prof's lectures. Began with one Prof, Kuyper, and five students. Today they have somewhere close to 15,000 students at the Free University of Amsterdam. Many of us wonder whether it's still the good old Free, but okay, it's there. On the occasion of the founding of the Free University, Kuyper delivered the inaugural address in the big church in Amsterdam. And all the dignitaries of the country and the city were there, the politicians, the queen, and the representative, and all the people from the academic world. And he held one of his most famous speeches that really got at the heart of what everything he stood for was about. He called it Souveränität in eigen Kreis, sovereignty in its own circle. We would call it sphere sovereignty today. That was crucial. That was absolutely crucial to everything that Kuyper stood for, sphere sovereignty. And I must admit, this is somewhat of a regretful indictment upon my community, that I was never told anything about that. I grew up practically ignorant of it. And Rawlty, to be sure, but of Kuyper too. All the way through 12 grades of schooling, through 4 years of college, and 3 years of seminary. How many of that? It's about 20 years of schooling. Huh? That's about enough. Through all those years, I can only recall one teacher
ever spending, and he spent about 5 or 10 minutes on Abram Kuyper and the idea of sphere sovereignty. So I grew up in almost total ignorance of that which Kuyper took to be the heartbeat of his whole vision on life. Sovereignty. Sphere sovereignty. The sovereignty of the home, of the church, of the school, of the family, of the press, of labor, and so on. I'd like to get to that if we have a little time left toward the end. Well, that was kind of a kickoff speech. People knew right from then and there what Kuyper stood for. And then that vision, which said Christ is Lord of all, and that's true, then of course you can't stop with the church and you can't stop with the university. Then you've got to pick up the Christian school movement that Grun had begun. That's exactly what Kuyper did. And 100 years ago, 1876, was the big year, the petition drive. A new school law was being passed, which disenfranchised Christians even more than they had been before. The situation was much like we have today. Only the wealthy could afford an alternative to public school education. And poor middle-class people couldn't. They had to send them to the public schools, which were thoroughly secular. And now the new school law was going to be passed, which made the situation even worse. And Kuyper rallied his people. And, see, the law was being sent to the king for his signature. And so within 1 week, Kuyper was able to get 360,000 signatures. And they presented this in royal fashion to the king in August of 1878. And the king received them graciously, bade them farewell, and a couple of days later signed the law anyway. Now, you'd say, okay, sit back and call it quit. Kuyper said, no, that's only a rallying call. And from then on, every August 15 became the annual day for the reunion of the Society for the School of the Bible, the School of the Bible. Christian school movement took off from that defeat rather than rolling over and dying. And that's still done today. Every August is the meeting of that society that Calvin got started, or I'm sorry, Kuyper, for the Christian school movement. Then the Christian labor movement, and then the Christian political movement. Finally heading up in what was called the ARP, the Anti-Revolutionary Party. It sounds negative, and it was negative, against the spirit of the French Revolution. But it had a positive thrust, the lordship of Jesus Christ over all. Kuyper was trying to find ways to implement what he took to be the biblical confession. There's kein Daumenbreit, he would say. There's not a thumb breadth. The amount of room you can cover with your thumb, let's say a single square inch. There's not a single square inch of the universe of which Christ, the sovereign Lord of all, doesn't say, that's mine. You name it, Christ claims it. It's mine. In Washington or Moscow or Amsterdam or what have you, Christ says it's mine. And it's the calling of Christians to honor that claim and to seek to press it wherever they can. And that holds not only in the church and the school and the home, it holds in politics and labor and economics and business, you name it. All of it. Now that was the vision that drove Kuyper. Finally, he recognized that you have to be where the big decisions are made, and that's usually in Parliament. So Kuyper ran, and he was elected member of Parliament, and then around the turn of the century, for about 3 years, served as the Prime Minister of the Netherlands. On his 70th birthday, this is near the end of my biographical stuff, then I'd like to just sketch the outline of the vision a little bit. As his 70th birthday was approaching, his family said, Father, what would you like to have for your birthday? And they gave him three options. I can't remember the third one. One was a new tea table, because Kuyper drank tea in the afternoon. So they said, would you like to have a new tea table? Or something else? Or would you like to have all the political cartoons that have appeared in all the newspapers over the past 25 years or so put together into a book? That's what I'd like. And so they formed a committee, went through all the newspapers, and gathered together
all of these political cartoons from all, you know, those who just hated his guts. And they found ways of saying it as only a cartoonist can, you know. It's called Kuiper in the caricature, Kuiper in caricature. It's a caricature, it's a lampooning. Most of them are lampoonings of Kuiper. But Kuiper, that's the nature of a cartoon. A cartoon is not just a picture, a cartoon is saying something. And my opponents are saying something about my political convictions. And they're saying it in those cartoons. It'll be interesting to get them all put together. So they got them together. And when they were finished, they said, Kuiper, would you write the introduction? So that's what he said. He wrote the introduction. And in his own genial way, what it turned out to be was kind of his philosophy of cartooning. You know, he doesn't just say a few tidbits, you know. He gets down to the heart of what's cartooning about? What's the purpose of cartooning? What is good cartooning? How should Christians cartoon? And so he comes up with a kind of a Christian view of cartooning. Well, I wanted Robin Jensen of the art department to read it, but he can't read Dutch. So I translated it once and gave it to him and a few other people. I thought they might profit by that. Then in 1920 died. A lot of other things happened along the way. Two things I just want to mention yet. That school movement, which he helped, well, Groen had started it, Kuiper continued it, which he helped to bring to fruition, which they called the Schoolstrijd, the school struggle, which lasted, oh, a half a century of struggle for justice and equity in education. A half a century. And he did it basically in coalition with those people who shouted this week, Papa Novum Habibus, the Roman Catholic. He knew and they knew that they differed about philosophy of education. But he knew and they knew that in terms of law, they stood together. And that if the government is going to assist education, it ought to assist all education alike. And that any freedom that you have to pay for is not a freedom. And that parents ought to have freedom of choice in education, and so on. Well, that was Kuiper's vision, because he thought that's the task of government, if it's going to administer justly its task. And he worked with the Catholics and others, so that by 1920, the Gelijkstelling, as they call it, equality before the law of all schools had been achieved. And for the past half century, they've enjoyed that kind of situation. One more thing. About 1918, 2 years before Kuiper's death, he said, this vision, and it isn't mine, I've got it from St. Paul in the scriptures. Calvin helped me along, that congregation in Beist touched it off too, and other people have helped me, but especially Groen. When they asked Kuiper, where did you come up with the idea of sphere sovereignty? He said, ik meen dat van Groen te hebben gehoord. I think I heard it from Groen. Only Groen called it sphere independence rather than sovereignty, but the idea is basically the same. But this vision, which Kuiper tried to work out as a theologian, he sensed had to be worked out in a more penetrating type of analysis. He said, we need not only a Christian theology, we need a Christian philosophy. We need it in that university in Amsterdam. They had no Christian philosophy there. They had no philosophers. They had no chair of philosophy. It wasn't until 1926 that they appointed the first philosophers at the Free University of Amsterdam. And the two that they appointed were men by the name of Vollenhoven and Doyeweer. They were brother-in-law. One had been a minister and the other was a man of jurisprudence. Together they were appointed to teach philosophy in 1926, and for 40 years they devoted themselves to that task. Within a couple of years after they started, they published a little thing called In Kuiper's Line. The line of thought that runs through Kuiper, we want to work out that line of thought. As he did it in theology, we want to do it for philosophy. And that's the philosophy that has been developed. It's called the Amsterdam School of Philosophy, the Wijsbegeerte de Wetsidee, philosophy of theonomic law, different names for it, but it's associated with Vollenhoven as the historian and Doyeweer as the more systematic thinker. Now, before I say any more, I think I ought to stop and just open it up for questions, because otherwise it's going to run away from us again, just like last week. Yes, sir.
Do
Don't you think the church today is missing the boat by not taking a sincere interest in the Christian political action?
Absolutely. I think so. And I'm really concerned about it, because I find those who used to be called fundamentalists, who don't like that anymore, want to be known as evangelicals, and then the younger ones are known today as neo-evangelicals, they're getting concerned about social, economic, and political witness. And I'm concerned that we, who have had this rich heritage in terms of world and life view, not only in theory but in practice, are going to be finding ourselves in the back seats, and the evangelicals are going to be in the driver's seat. I hope they get there, but it's just too bad that we can't be there with them. And part of it is due to the fact that we still have too much of enrollment in us. Now, I'm not saying we've got to get rid of enrollment, but I think that the reformation of Calvinism in the 19th century needed a Kuyper to complete that which Benralty had begun. And to stop with Benralty is to stop short of the full vision. Yeah.
Would that be considered pietism versus activism? Would you say that at the beginning of this?
The beauty, as I see it, of Kuyper's vision is that it gives a place to piety. Kuyper wrote books, you know, a devotional book, very stirring meditations. What is it? That very famous one, How to New Hampshire. When you sit in your home, How to New Hampshire. And a whole raft of them. So piety, deeply devotional meditation, that was close to Kuyper. But there was more to life than that, he said. The active dimension has to be there. The active dimension was kind of absent in Benralty, at least culturally active. And what I find beautiful about Kuyper's vision is that it gives to these various dimensions of life its own place, without saying that meditation is what the Christian life is all about, or action is what the Christian life is all about, or thinking is what the Christian life is all about. It gives a place for thinking, for meditation, for prayer, for action within the total world and life view. Yes?
What strikes me when you read Kuyper, this very thing that you talked about a moment ago, namely, there's a healthy pietist there. And yet, he combines that with a tremendous, sweeping world and life view. But, you know, when you think of that, how is it possible that things have degenerated for so many years in a country that had a background like that?
Okay, that's a long story. I'd rather ask, where are we?
Well, that's fine.
Yeah. But it's true, there is a very healthy, down-to-earth piety in Kuyper, which doesn't fight, you know, his involvement in politics and so on. He said, you know, it doesn't do any good to go into the parliament and waving all kinds of Jesus banners. That doesn't do any good. If you can't translate your confession into politics, then forget it. It doesn't do any good to hold prayer breakfasts if you can't carry over from prayer into politics. It's got to shape and mold your politics so that your politics are different than the rest of the guys. Because otherwise, you might just as well quit before you start. He wanted to be able to translate that heart confession into political language, into academic language, into every language in life. I've often thought, now why in the world can't we, as a Reformed Christian community in Western Michigan, support at least a Christian weekly? A Catholic diocese has a weekly going, and I bet you we're in no worse shape than they are. Why can't we have at least a Christian weekly to give, you know, to counteract that secular brainwashing that goes on day after day after day with the Grand Rapids Press and the Holland Sentinel? At least they got a beginning of it coming out of Canada with the Calvinist Contact. But that's naturally oriented to the Canadian scene. But we ought to do that. Why do our kids have to be exposed to secularism day after day after day after day after day in the newspaper? Yeah.
Did you ever see that magazine,
Gordon, where Hovind started one just before the Second World War. It was to be in competition with Time magazine. A few copies came out of it.
No, I didn't see that. Many attempts were made in the 1920s.
There was one there. It was rather interesting. He was pro-Hitler in that magazine.
See, that's the problem, that unless we really think about these things for a while, we're going to identify Christianity, let's say, with a free enterprise system. And then we say, a free enterprise system, that's Christian, whatever you want. Or we say, Hitler, you know, strong man, that's Christian. That's what this world needs. You know, we begin to identify Christianity with some existing institution in such a way that we can't address the gospel critically to it anymore. Yeah?
You use the term spirit dominion, groom, and spirit obligation, Kuiper. I would refer another term to it, spirit responsibility.
Okay.
And then when we talk about the church going into politics, we certainly don't mean that.
Church into politics.
No, we don't want the church in politics. No. We want church people.
You're
thinking of the church as the body of Christ.
We want the church in politics, not the church. The basic meaning of church in the Bible is people. You can blow this place to smithereens, you don't destroy the church. The church is people. The people of God, the body of Jesus Christ, they ought to be in politics. But I don't think the CRC ought to be in politics. But the CRC, through its pulpits, its preaching, its teaching, ought to stimulate the body of Christ to get off their dock and get moving on Proposal H, for example, that's coming up, and like it or not, in every detail, it seems to me it's more just than what we've got today. Because I think in the long run, an income tax is a more just form of tax than property tax, and a tuition voucher plan is more just than the state monopoly that we've got. So you may not like the way they're tied together, but take one side at a time, and you've got to say there's more justice, potentially, in that proposal than what we're experiencing today. And I think that we Christians ought to say something like that. And maybe we ought to, you know, support movements that are trying to foster a Christian political mind and a Christian political movement, like APJ, because I've been a board member of that. Yes, sir.
To what extent do you think the First Amendment to the Constitution would preclude Kuiper today, or the way the First Amendment is interpreted?
That's a terribly tangled question, and we're trying to work our way through it. I'm involved this year in the Calvin Center for Christian Scholarship, and I, along with five other people, four faculty people and two students, the faculty people are devoting two-thirds of their time to this research topic, public justice and educational equity. And I think our Supreme Court has left us with utter ambiguity. I don't think they know which end is up and down anymore, if you look at one decision after another. And I think you can begin to explain why there's utter confusion in the decision. Because the First Amendment was never intended to speak to the question of schools. It meant churches. When it said, shall not establish religion, it means that the government should not establish the Christian Reformed or Catholic or any other church. But we all identify religion and faith and God and the Bible with church. Everything that's spiritual belongs to church, and everything that's secular belongs to state, and the spiritual and the secular have got to be separate, and there you go. I think the courts have... I think we're living with a constitution which is unconstitutional.
Question,
I mean, by God's
grace. Something puzzles me. Maybe it's a dumb question, but how does publication of secular movie reviews in the official church paper, how does that fit into this? I'm puzzled by that.
We'll take another
15 minutes.
I mean, to translate
like
that with
either.
Specific.
Let me say it that
way. To translate it with specific, you know, action.
Yeah, I don't care for that. You can argue, look, the kids are going anyway, they ought to have some guidance. But I think that
does that fit into Kuyper's philosophy at all, or penetrating the world?
Kuyper would say we ought to establish our own Christian movie industry. We ought to come out with some Christian movies, not just sit there and pick at off everything that's coming off. But if the movie media is a legitimate way to get ideas across, then Christians ought to be doing it. Yeah.
Why are some of our leaders promoting the whole religion in our papers?
I don't know why. I think I know. Some, I don't know. A partially legitimate fear of the state. Oh, they're afraid of the state. I know I talked to Dr. Leonard Greenway the other day. He had his radio show, and somebody called in and said that they were afraid of it too, and he said he was too. And they asked me if I would talk to him about it to get a more positive approach across. So I did talk with him. He's going to read a statement that he asked me to present. But I think if you say, I'm afraid of government, don't say anymore, that we're derelict in our duty. If the government's that bad, we ought to be in there, not running away from it. And part of it is related to that. I understand you had a meeting here in this community last night. Didn't Dr. John Vandenberg speak?
Right.
Okay. On some of these issues. Fear of government control. Well, if you're afraid of government control, you ought to be running scared right now. Because our schools, without a cent of assistance, are already under 40 or 50 or 60 forms of government control. The question is not whether you're going to control or not. The control is already there. We're meeting all their standards. All the relevant standards we're meeting. Why can't they come across with at least a token of a bit of justice? So, sure, I understand what some of the concerns are, but if this passes, and I'm hoping it does, but if it passes, then we're going to have to watch the legislature. But then we have a right to speak, too, and make sure that the laws that implement this decision come out right. And if finally the laws come out and say, but you got to teach like public school, then I say, keep your money. We'll go our own way again. I'm not going to sell them out, you know. But I do think it's high time that we remind the government again and again of what justice means in education. Because we're getting a monopolistic society. You have no real choices in politics, Republican, Democrat, but that's no choice. Because what the Republicans fought 20 years ago, they're all pushing today. My folks fought Social Security. They said it's socialistic. Now you're all getting Social Security. You don't mind it. Republicans are just Democrats come on 20 years behind. That's about all the difference. There's no difference at bottom between, they're both committed to the same principles that faith and politics don't mix, and that you got to give people what they want in order to win elections. And you got to try to get 51% of the vote.